Friends, this body is so impermanent, fragile, unworthy of confidence and feeble. It is so insubstantial, perishable, short-lived, painful, filled with diseases and subject to changes. Thus, my friends, as this body is only a vessel of many sicknesses, wise men do not rely on it. This body is like a ball of foam, unable to bear any pressure. It is like a water bubble, not remaining very long. It is like a mirage born from the appetites of the passions. It is like the trunk of the plantain tree, having no core. Alas, this body is like a machine, a nexus of bones and tendons. It is like a magical illusion, consisting of falsifications. It is like a dream, being an unreal vision. It is like a reflection, being the image of former actions. It is like an echo, being dependent on conditioning. It is like a cloud, being characterized by turbulence and dissolution. It is like a flash of lightning, being unstable and decaying every moment. The body is ownerless, being the product of a variety of conditions. This body is inert like the earth, selfless like water, lifeless like fire, impersonal like the wind, and non-substantial like space. This body is unreal, being a collocation of the four main elements. It is void, not existing as self or as self-possessed. It is inanimate, being like grass, trees, walls, clods of earth, and hallucinations. It is insensate, being driven like a windmill. It is filthy, being an agglomeration of pus and excrement. It is false, being fated to be broken and destroyed, in spite of being anointed and massaged. It is afflicted by the 404 diseases. It is like an ancient well, constantly overwhelmed by old age. Its duration is never certain. Certain only is its end in death. This body is a combination of aggregates, elements, and sense media, which are comparable to murderers, poisonous snakes, and an empty town, respectively. Therefore, you should be revulsed by such a body. You should despair of it, and should arouse your admiration for the body of the Tathagata. Friends, the body of a Tathagata is the body of Dharma, born of gnosis. The body of a Tathagata is born of the stores of merit and wisdom. It is born of morality, of meditation, of wisdom, of the liberations and the knowledge and of the knowledge and vision of liberation. It is born of love, compassion, joy and equanimity. It is born of generosity, discipline and self-control. It is born of the path of the 10 virtues. It is born of patience and gentleness. It is born of the roots of virtue planted by solid efforts. It is born of the concentrations, the liberations, the meditations, and the absorptions. It is born of learning, wisdom, and skillful means. It is born of the 37 aids to enlightenment. It is born of mental quiescence and transcendental insight. It is born of the 10 powers, the 4 fearlessnesses, and the 18 special qualities. It is born of all the transcendences. It is born from sciences and superknowledges. It is born of the abandonment of all evil qualities and of the collection of all good qualities. It is born of truth. It is born of reality. It is born of conscious awareness. Friends, the body of a Tathagata is born of immeasurable good works. Towards such a body you should turn your aspirations. And in order to eliminate the sicknesses of the passions of all living beings, you should give rise to the excellent bodhicitta. While the Lichavi Vimalakirti thus taught the Dharma to those who had come to inquire about his sickness, many hundreds of thousands of living beings gave rise to the bodhicitta. Wow. So that's Vimalakirti's first great formal teaching in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. He's lying on his couch, he's on his sick bed. Everybody is very concerned about that. This happens in India when a great man is sick. Everybody will come and gather around the house. They want to know what's going on. So word has got out that Vimalakirti is sick. So a great group of people in the great city of Vaishali, all the royalty and all the eminent people, they've all come. And his response is to teach. Of course, he's manifested sickness as a skillful means, although he is actually sick as well as manifesting sickness. Might go into that tomorrow. And he teaches. I don't know if you teach the Dharma when you're sick, but that's what great bodhisattvas do. It's a teaching. And he teaches the utter impermanence, insubstantiality, unreliability and fragility of the conditioned human body. And the word for body, of course, is kaya, which is really describing the whole total psychophysical system, this whole conditioned being that we are. And I'm sure some of the things that you heard there you found really shocking, and you might even be wondering, well, where's the self-metta in this? You know, all this stuff about how repulsive it is and how you should despair of this body and so on. But Vimalakirti would probably say, if you raised that question or such a reflection on the nature of this kaya, this whole conditioned system, that in fact is a real and genuine care of the self, if you were to engage in that. We actually need to see this body, this conditioned body and mind, this restricted, samsaric being, for what it really is and what we really are. We are fated, as Vimalakirti says, to be broken and destroyed. We don't know when the time of death will come. It's absolutely certain that we will die, but we have no idea when it will come. It's fated, this body, to be broken and destroyed, in spite of being anointed and massaged, Vimalakirti says. I think those last two words, being anointed and massaged, I take that to be Vimalakirti's concession to caring for the body. And of course, we do need to do that. We do need to care for our bodies. Vimalakirti would, I'm sure, agree with that, though I hope he doesn't show up right now and give me a good talking to you. You have to be very careful when you invoke Vimalakirti or when you talk about him, because you don't know when he's going to sort of show up and give you a good slap. And I must say, this retreat so far, I found very humiliating. You know, giving these talks is all very well, but I'm actually finding the finger being pointed at to me rather strongly. Yes, we do need to recognise the preciousness of our human body, of our human personality. We need to nourish our body. We need to keep it in good repair. We need good health. We need to clothe it and to house this body, of course. And at the same time, we need to recognise fully and completely its utter impermanence and insubstantiality, and the fact that this conditioned body and mind is not a refuge. It's deeply unreliable. It breaks down. It is overwhelmed by illness, aging, and death. And I have to say, frankly, when I turn to that reflection, and of course, I have to make sure that I'm in a positive state to do that, my metta and my faith and my confidence in the Dharma, my going for refuge, needs to be very strong. But when I turn to that truth of this, the utter fragility and unreliability of this human frame, it's a relief. It's such a relief to turn to it and to see it and to accept the situation as it really is. I think a lot of tension that people experience in life is because people suppress or even repressed the reality of their life, the reality of their body. And that creates an enormous amount of tension, because we're constantly in denial about the reality and, in a sense, the peril and the fragility of our circumstances and situation. But of course, the truth keeps breaking through, and one day it will break through in a way that we just cannot possibly ignore. Although even then, people still try to ignore it. I was a few years ago, I was hospitalised with appendicitis, and I was in a ward with people who were really quite, you know, some very serious, you know, gastric operations. And I could see with some of them, the way they were sort of talking, it was very much, I even overheard conversations at night time, it was very much the language of, well, why me? Why is this happening? You know, this shouldn't be happening. This is a sort of mistake. It was really so poignant and sort of tragic to hear it. And I certainly felt some anxiety about my health at that time, because I'd never been spent time in hospital before. But I thought, well, at least I've got the information from my Dharma practice that this is what happens. This is what can happen. It, you know, it gave me a certain confidence, I suppose, even though I wasn't finding it particularly easy. But at least I'd been told and I'd meditated upon the fact of impermanence and death. And I had a way of working with what was going on. And perhaps one of the reasons why we don't look, we feel we can't look and accept our situation, is because we only see this body and this life. That's the only reality, in a sense. We are profoundly materialistic. And of course, that's reinforced by the ease with which we can consume these days. Our consumer society, I think, just feeds our fundamentally materialistic outlook. It's just so easy to get what we want, you know, with the click, you know, of a Amazon icon. We need then a positive and creative alternative to this conditioned frame. And Vimalakirti, of course, gives that. He says, friends, you must, instead of, you know, of dwelling on this body, arouse your admiration for the body of the Tathagata Kaya, the whole, how do you call it? Do you call it a psychophysical organism? I don't know what you call it, but the whole being of enlightenment, the Tathagata Kaya. Actually, the literal translation, you must direct your aspirations to the body of the Tathagata. In other words, you're aiming your life at having a completely new kaya, a completely new psychophysical being. It's not something that you just admire, although admiration and reverence and faith and devotion is tremendously important. It's why we have all the imagery. But you need to actually develop the aspirations to develop that kaya, that body of the Buddha, that the body of the enlightenment, which is born out of the development of all the qualities of the Dharma. And Vimalakirti talks about, mentions these: morality, meditation, and wisdom, the four Brahma Viharas, love, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity, the 10 precepts that we take at ordination, the path of the 10 virtues. That gives birth to the Tathagata Kaya. Wisdom, deep meditation, skillful means, that gives rise, that gives birth to the Tathagata Kaya. And at the end, he says, this body of the Buddha, this body of the Tathagata, is born of truth, born of reality, born of conscious awareness, in Robert Thurman's translation. The word that he's translated conscious awareness by is apramada, vigilance, mindfulness, alertness, lack of intoxication, wakefulness. It's interesting that he ends with that. In a way, you could say that wakefulness, that apramada, that vigilance, is the basis for all these qualities. And I find all this incredibly inspiring, I must say. You aim to develop that body. You aim to be spiritually reborn as that body. But he says at the end, you aim to develop that body, to give birth to that body, to remove the sicknesses of all living beings. It's not just for yourself, it's for the benefit of all. What an inspiring teaching from the sick bed. Amazing. Wow. That's something to aspire to in itself. Aim to get to a point that when you're sick, you're actually going to teach the Dharma in a way that enables others to raise the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment. But it's also inspiring in another way. I know sometimes people can, you know, we struggle to develop along in the Dharma, but maybe this would be a more inspiring way of thinking. When we're practicing ethics and meditation and Dharma study and spiritual friendship, going on retreat, we're giving birth to a new body. We're giving birth to the body of the Buddha, to the Tathagatakaya, through all these practices. You know, I remember once Sangharakshita saying about meditation, perhaps it would be more inspiring if people realised that in meditation they're actually giving birth to a new body, a new kind of experience of the body through meditation practices. Also reminds me, this particular teaching, of the recollection of the Buddha practice, the Buddhanu Sati, the Buddhanu Smriti practice, which is a central Buddhist practice from earliest times, where people would bring to mind the qualities of the Buddha, just keep going over them in their mind, particularly the qualities mentioned in the Buddha Vandana, the first part of the Tiratnavandana. This is a teaching that the Buddha gave himself. You reflect on those qualities, but you also imagine that the Buddha is present before you in some way as you recollect those qualities. And one of the things that the benefits of doing a practice like this, it says that your body becomes a shrine room. Your body becomes a temple. I remember once, was it Edgar Davids, the footballer, saying when he was accused of taking drugs, he said, "My body is a temple." Well, yes, maybe. But the real body is a temple is whether or not you have the presence of the Buddha within it, not some sort of version of narcissism, where you're just sort of shaping your body just to feel good about yourself and, you know, to primp and preen yourself in front of others. I'm sure Edgar Davids is not like that. But your real body as a temple is whether or not you have meditated on the Buddha. Because it means you're carrying the Buddha with you all the time in everything that you do. And this brings us, of course, this reminds us of what happens at ordination. In your private ordination, where you go alone to your preceptor who individually witnesses directly you're going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, in the course of that ordination, he gives you an initiation into a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva. He transmits the mantra of a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. And Sangharakshita has said the significance of this particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, what you're doing when you meditate on that Buddha or Bodhisattva, you're meditating on you at the end of the path. You at the end of the whole course of the Dharma. You as you will be, if you're willing to be spiritually die and be spiritually reborn. You're drawing your nourishment from the highest and deepest that you have a resonance with, that you have a potentiality for. If you're prepared to renounce and let go of your conditioned being, you're visualizing, you're contemplating, you're imagining the qualities of Buddhahood that really speaks to you directly, that really communicates with you, not just as a set of ideas and concepts, but as a living, imagined, vivid experience. And in the course of meditations on that, you will receive blessings from the figure. You'll even attain a sort of union with that figure. We saw in the first talk about building the Buddha land, working with others to build the Buddha land, but also equally individually, we need to give birth to the Buddha as part of our building the Buddha land. Personally, individually, we need to give birth. We need to bring in to being the Buddha. And when we work with others to do that, we've got more of a chance of building the Buddha land. I remember once Sangharakshita was asked, why is it so important that all order members should do their personal meditation on their Buddha or Bodhisattva every day? This was the recommendation that Bhante used to give. I think that nowadays it might be observed more in the breach than in the actual reality. I hope that's not true. But his reply was very interesting. He said, if all order members were meditating every day on the Buddha or Bodhisattva they would be given at ordination, it would bring deep unity and harmony to the order. It's for the harmony and unity of the order. Because he said, each day that means people are meditating on the highest. And they're recollecting also their ordination. They're going for refuge vividly. So it will bring about deeper unity, deeper harmony. And that means there'll be more energy, of course, to build the Buddha land. So a bit of a reflection for the order members present on that one. And those of you who've asked for ordination, take a little vow now that when you're ordained, you will meditate on your Buddha or Bodhisattva every day in some way or other. I recommend it. It's been my practice for a very, very long time now. And I don't think I'm doing too badly. And it's also related to the whole business of gaining enlightenment. I had a conversation with a young man a few months ago, and he asked me, I think, a very good question. Do you think you can gain enlightenment in this life? Are you going for enlightenment in this life? It's very important to him because, you know, he wants to gain enlightenment in this life. And I found myself laughing at the question. And I said, no, I can't gain enlightenment in this life. I can't. There has to be a complete transformation for enlightenment to arise. There has to be a spiritual death and rebirth in order for enlightenment to happen. Me now can't. You know, that's just grabbing something and adding it to you. I've got to go through a whole process of transformation. But I said, what I do every day is contemplate enlightenment. And I do that particularly in the meditation practice I was given by Sangharakshita at ordination. Every day there is a contemplation of the qualities of enlightenment. Every day I'm drawing on that. I'm nourished by that. That informs everything that I do. That's the most important element in the day, actually, from a certain point of view. And here it brings up the whole topic of sort of speed or closeness to enlightenment. Sometimes people are very, very bothered about this. You've got to be going for it. You've got to be going for insight. You've got to be irreversible as soon as possible. And there's a certain, sense in which that's quite a sincere aspiration. But when you're contemplating enlightenment regularly, when you're resonating with it, when your shraddha, your faith, is aroused, you're not bothered about closeness or distance. That doesn't interest you. That is irrelevant. All that matters is that you're evoking the qualities of Buddhahood regularly in your life. And you're being inspired by them and moved by them. Attainments can take care of themselves. You don't need to worry about them. You don't need to think about them. You just need to keep contemplating Buddhahood in everything that you do and be moved by that in all of your actions. In one of Sangharakshita's lectures, the lecture where he talks about perfumes, the mystery of human communication, he refers to this very, very profound text from East Asian Buddhism, the awakening of faith in the Mahayana, the awakening of faith in the great principle. And in that particular treatise, there's a whole discussion about the mutual perfuming of the mundane and the transcendental, of the conditioned and the unconditioned. The mutual perfuming of suchness. Very, very interesting, mysterious way of talking. And Sangharakshita says this is very, very profound. Well, this is what we perhaps need to be looking at much more. Looking to be perfumed by that dimension. Letting it influence us in all that we do. Who knows? After his teaching, this great teaching on the body, Vimalakirti says this: I am ailing, suffering, lying on a couch, and the Tathagata, the Arhat, the perfectly enlightened one, is not concerned about me. He has no compassion for me whatsoever, and sends no one to inquire about my illness. Oh, poor Vimalakirti. And the Buddha knows what Vimalakirti is thinking, far away in Amrapali's park. And presumably Vimalakirti knows that the Buddha knows what he's thinking. In other words, there's a wonderful game, a play, a leela going on between them, a bodhisattva leela between them. They know, you know, and I think Vimalakirti is actually saying this in front of everybody. He's saying, you know, the Buddha really doesn't care about me. You know, so there's this wonderful game going on between them. Fantastic. And so the Buddha asks various disciples, enlightened disciples and bodhisattvas, one by one, to go to that good man, that worthy man, Vimalakirti, to inquire about his sickness and illness. This happens actually quite often in the early sutras, you know, in the Buddha of history. Somebody is sick, the Buddha hears about it, and if he can't go himself to see how they are, he sends a disciple to go and inquire and to console them and to see how they're getting on. It's quite a feature in Buddhist tradition. People aren't just left. You know, sickness, illness is seen as something where, you know, in particular, the Dharma needs to be strongly present. So the Buddha will either go himself and respond, or he'll send someone to really keep an eye on that person. Perhaps a bit of a reflection for us there. But although the Buddha asks one by one these different disciples and bodhisattvas to go, they refuse. Because they've encountered Vimalakirti before. And that has been a devastating experience, and they really don't want to repeat that. They really don't want to be on the end of that. So the Buddha asks, for example, Shariputra to go and inquire after Vimalakirti's health and what's going on with him and find out about his sickness. And Shariputra says, I really do not want to go, Bhagavan, to see that man. I remember one day I was sitting under a tree meditating, completely absorbed in meditation. Vimalakirti turned up and he said to me, that is not the way to be absorbed in meditation. You're meditating wrong. And then he gives him a whole discourse on what it means to be really absorbed in meditation, selflessly absorbed in meditation. I won't go into all that. And Shariputra said, after hearing this teaching from that good man, I was dumbfounded. I didn't know what to say. I felt confused and bewildered. So different arahants come forward. Pali, Purana, Subhuti, Mahakashyapa, many of them. And some of them would have been teaching a group of people, even sort of, you know, upbraiding some monks for breaking the precepts. Others might have been teaching the Dharma to a group of laymen, laywomen. Others might have been begging. And in other words, the classic practices of the monastic life. And Vimalakirti had turned up to each one of them and shows the limitations of their practice and their teaching and indicates how it really should be done. And his effect is incredible. He you know, when the people they're talking to or they're interacting with hear Vimalakirti teach, they are precipitated into a higher state of consciousness. And these poor disciples are completely dumbfounded, don't know what to say, feel humiliated in some ways. And as Sangharakshita says, you know, they hear the truth of what Vimalakirti is saying, but they don't know what to do about it. There's a sort of, they understand it, but there's a lag between their understanding and doing something about it. I should just say at this point, and this is really, really important, the arahants in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, even though they have all the names of the arahants in the Pali Canon, are not the arahants of the Pali Canon. This is really, really important. The Shariputra of the Vimalakirti Nidesha is not the Shariputra of Buddhist history, and so on and so forth. This is really important. They symbolize a certain kind of limited practice, you know, in the sutra, and we mustn't confuse them with those great arahants who are really like bodhisattvas, who are bodhisattvas of the Pali Canon. So it's very, very important to read these texts, you know, critically. It's not really Shariputra who was the great general of the Dharma in the Pali Canon. This is to do with the development of Buddhist history that we can't really go into. And the bodhisattvas don't get off any lighter either. I mean, for example, Maitreya, who of course is the next Buddha, he's the Buddha of the distant future who's been predicted to Buddhahood by Shakyamuni. He's in the Tushita Devaloka teaching the sons of the gods all about irreversibility. Irreversibility from supreme and enlightenment. And Vimalakirti pops up and shows the limitations of his teaching on irreversibility and takes apart the whole idea of prediction. Well, he takes apart the whole idea of past, present and future. You know, more or less says, well, past, present and future are only notions. Well, how can you be predicted to anything? You know, how can you gain enlightenment in a future that doesn't exist? Completely blows him apart. Gives a whole teaching on suchness. Has a real go at the notion of personal irreversibility anyway, saying Maitreya, more or less saying Maitreya, you're not that special. Because the instant you achieve complete nirvana, all beings will achieve complete nirvana. So completely, so what's so special about you? And I think this is really, really important because of the sort of, you know, in some ways the obsession that people can have with a personal attainment. Well, if you're really concerned with personal attainment, you've really seriously missed the point. And Vimalakirti says, stop misleading these gods that you're teaching. This is the real teaching. Of course, when Vimalakirti teaches, they really wake up. And Maitreya is stunned, silent. So he says to the Buddha, I'm really reluctant to go. And of course, Vimalakirti is sick. They're still scared of him. In Sangharakshita's talk on this section, he calls it the transcendental critique of religion. It's a really important lecture. And what the main point, really, just to simplify, is that all Dharma teachings and practices are there to bring about the growth, the maturing, the liberation, the emancipation, the enlightenment of the individual practicing. They're not ends in themselves. That's the great point. And Vimalakirti is like a great vajra, a great lightning bolt, a great thunderbolt, breaking through, bursting through, showing what these particular practices and teachings are really for. That's what he's doing in these teachings. And we have to ask that of ourselves. We need to invoke Vimalakirti regularly in our own practice. So all the members need to be asking themselves, why am I doing this? What is this for? This practice, this teaching. And those of you, I'm going to address you in particular because there's more of you here, those of you in the ordination process, those of you training for ordination, you need to ask yourselves why you're engaging in this ordination training. It can happen that people do get lost in their ordination training. They lose their inspiration. They lose the initial vision that prompted them to ask for ordination in the first place. They lose their connection with the living spirit of going for refuge. They lose their connection with that sense of their Dharma life being a living thing and a growing thing, with that maturing and that liberation that goes with that maturing. They think much more in terms of trying to get ordained, as if ordination is a thing that they're going to be given and then they'll be made men. You know, like joining the mafia or something. I remember Sangharakshita writing in his travel letters about when he first went to New Zealand, how there was a really weird atmosphere about getting ordained because people had heard that Bhante was going to be ordaining people. And some people's attitudes, he said, were so grabby, as if ordination was a thing in Bhante's briefcase that he brought from London and he was going to give them, rather than the realisation that ordination is a recognition of what is actually happening, arises out of somebody's actual living Dharma life, their spiritual life, and that is seen and witnessed and recognized in this case by Sangharakshita. So sometimes people can feel that they're, you know, these are the phrases that get trotted out, the cliches. I'm just ticking the boxes. I'm not going to tick the boxes. I'm not going to jump over hurdles. I'm jumping over hurdles. All this sort of language, as if that's what the ordination team have done here. We've sort of sat down and say, how can we get them to tick all the boxes? How can we get them to jump over all the hurdles? That's not what we're about at all. And it's amazing that people could think that that's what we would want you to do. Everything that we've set up, everything that we do, is there to help you to understand deeply the nature of ordination, the nature of going for refuge, and to help you connect and live from going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. Of course, we might not always be, it's possible that we might be failing to do that. It's also possible that you might be failing to understand and really get the spirit of what we're getting at. But what we're concerned to communicate is a vibrant Dharmacharya, a vibrant life in the Dharma. You have to live it. We can't do it for you. We can't tell you how to do it. You have to live it from yourselves. And sometimes, I know some people have, you know, feel that they've lost the connection so profoundly that they need to take a break from the ordination process. They just have to stop coming to Padmaloka for a while, pull out of different things. They need to take a break. They might even withdraw their ordination request. And I think that can be, in some cases, quite a useful thing to do. They need to kind of look deeper. They just can't see their life, their Dharma life, within this context. They have to kind of, you know, go back to the beginning and build up from there. Sometimes it can come out of people being too impatient to get ordained. They want to be ordained really quickly. They think they can be ordained really quickly. And they're so concerned with that, they're not really leading the life that they need to lead. Some people, I've also shocked some people who you know, appear to be taking or thought they're going to take the nice scenic route to ordination. You get people like that. And I say, well, what about it? What about soon? What about in the next year or two? And you can see them sort of jump out of their skin. That's quite fun when you do that. you know, because, you know, actually they're doing better than they think they are. But the issue always with the ordination process is living your life. I know some of you probably are quite in touch with that, but that is really important. It's really important not to sort of think, I know what I'll do, I'll just pretend, and, you know, I won't, well, not pretend, I'm sure you wouldn't think that, but I'll ignore this area and that area, get ordained, and then I'll sort it all out. Bad idea. Very bad idea if you do that, because the unresolved areas tend to arise very, very strongly after the act of commitment, and that can cause quite a conflict. So you need to live your life very, very fully, live your Dharma life very, very fully. You need to ask yourself, well, what am I doing? Do I really want to do this? Good question. Am I maturing and growing through engaging in this life? And you also, I think, have to be very robust in the ordination training, in the ordination process. I mean, these retreats aren't beginner's retreats. You've probably noticed that we don't sort of facilitate you. We don't kind of pull our punches on the ordination team. We're going to tell you how we see it, how we see the Dharma life, the order life. And we expect you to be robust and to come back and to, you know, not compromise yourselves in relation to that. And also another thing I'll say in relation to this, and I think this is going to be the last thing I'm going to say about the ordination process, don't be vague. I was talking to a group of men who've asked for ordination recently, and I just noticed that they're just so vague about what they were doing. You know, they go to their going for refuge group, they do this, they do that. Do you know what you've asked for? That's what I was saying. It was like, do you know what you really want in your life? Do you know what it means, asking for ordination and living this life? and entering the ordination training. Don't be vague, be clear. Go back to that teaching of Vimalakirti. This life is very short and fragile. Be clear about what you're doing. Be clear about what you want to do. Remember years ago, a young man was very frustrated. He really wanted to be ordained, and he wasn't ready, you know, and he had lots of unresolved areas. And we were having this argument, and I said, look, I think you should think the unthinkable. What's the unthinkable? Withdraw your ordination request and go and live your life. He was really shocked, sort of devastated. I said, this isn't working. This is painful. You know, you're not going to get ordained like this. You know, this is really awful. And he was very, very grateful. It was the worst thing. He really didn't want to hear it. He went off. He sorted out a few things. He's ordained now. He came back much stronger, you know, refreshed by that. He gave himself permission, if you like, not to be ordained. You know, he turned it into something oppressive. Doesn't need to be oppressive. Live your life. But back to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. There's one particular bodhisattva's encounter with Vimalakirti that I want to talk about. Hopefully I've got time to do this. This is the encounter that Jagatindara has with Vimalakirti. So Jagatindara, I think, is probably a young novice bodhisattva. He's at home, and maybe he's meditating or just sitting there quietly or something, and Indra, the king of the gods, in a blaze of light, with 12,000 heavenly maidens, stunningly beautiful, and there's celestial music and song sounding, turns up. Wow. These stunningly beautiful goddesses, Indra, the king of the gods, and the young bodhisattva Jagatindara. Woo! And Indra bows and salutes. He's very humble, and he entreats a teaching from Jagatindara. And Jagatindara is very good. He gives Indra the right teaching. In the midst of your pleasures, the pleasures of the gods, you must be continually attentive, and you must have apramada, mindfulness of impermanence. Keep impermanence in mind and dwell on what's really substantial. Now, presumably he means the Dharma. And Indra is very grateful, very moved by this teaching from Jagatindara. He's so grateful, he says, Reverend Jagatindara, have these 12,000 maidens. Have these heavenly maidens. They're yours. Take them as your servants. And Jagatindara is really, really shocked. He said, but I'm a summoner. I'm a renunciate. I can't accept these goddesses, these heavenly maidens as my servants. You know, that's not appropriate for me. So he's really... Oh dear, he's really shocked. I mean, he's done the right thing. Very pure, young bodhisattva doing the right thing. And at that moment, Vimalakirti appears. He said, Jagatindara, Reverend Jagatindara, this isn't really Indra. This is Mara. And he's come to make a fool of you. He's come with his heavenly maidens, Mara's heavenly maidens, that's who they really are. They're his sort of daughters, or whoever they are, we're not quite clear. This is Mara, the evil one, and he's come to humiliate you. And Vimalakirti then turns to Mara and says, since Jagatindara can't have these heavenly maidens, give them to me, Mara. I'm a householder. I can have the 12,000 heavenly maidens of my servants. And Mara was terrified, absolutely terrified. He's been seen and named by Vimalakirti. And Mara tries to get away from Vimalakirti, but he's held by Vimalakirti's awesome magic power. He's riddy, he can't get away. And he doesn't want to give these heavenly maidens to Vimalakirti. He wants them with him. So I'm not going to give you the heavenly maidens, Vimalakirti. And then a voice, there's a sort of standoff, and then a voice from the sky says, Mara, give the heavenly maidens to Vimalakirti. And this voice has such authority. I don't know if it's the Dharmakaya or reality itself, but Mara has to give the heavenly maidens to Vimalakirti. There they are, the daughters of the gods. And Mara wants to get away, but Vimalakirti won't let him get away. Mara is terror-stricken, and very, very reluctantly he gives the beautiful goddesses to Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti communicates there and then to the heavenly maidens, to the goddesses. He teaches them how to give rise to the bodhicitta, the force of wisdom and compassion, the motivation to gain enlightenment for all beings. And then Vimalakirti says to them, now that you've developed the bodhicitta, from now on you will take pleasure and confidence in the pleasure gardens of the Dharma, the Dharma Arama. You will now take your pleasure and confidence in the pleasure gardens of the Dharma. So the heavenly maidens say, oh, Vimalakirti, what is this pleasure and confidence found in the pleasure gardens of the Dharma? And Vimalakirti gives a teaching, a great teaching on the pleasure. And the word here is rati, pleasure, delight, usually a word associated with sensual pleasure, the delight, the pleasure to be found in all the classical Dharma practices. It's all there, the pleasure that you find in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the pleasure that you find in all the aspects of the path, the pleasure that you find in deep meditation, the pleasure that you find in spiritual friendship, the pleasure that you find in wisdom, the pleasure that you find in skillful means, the pleasure that you find in enlightenment. He goes on and on like that. Mara, he hasn't given up. He wants those goddesses back. He obviously can't live without them. He says, come on, girls. It's not quite like that in the sutra. Come on. It's time to go back to our celestial abode. And the goddesses don't want to go. They really like being with Vimalakirti. They much prefer Vimalakirti to being with Mara. And they say, well, you've given us to Vimalakirti, Mara. From now on, we're going to take our delight and pleasure and confidence in the pleasure gardens of the Dharma. We're going to stay here with this man. So go on home alone. Mara doesn't give up. So he says to Vimalakirti, it's said that a bodhisattva should feel no regret in giving away everything that he possesses. So give me back the daughters of the gods. And Vimalakirti says, they are given, Mara. Return with them to your celestial abode. But act so as to fill the Dharma aspirations of all living beings. Off you go. And the goddesses, I think they're a bit sad at leaving that wonderful Vimalakirti. And they ask for a teaching. They say, how do we practice? How should we live? How should we conduct ourselves when we return to the realm of Mara? And Vimalakirti says, sisters, there is a Dharma door to liberation called the inexhaustible lamp. What is it? Sisters, a single lamp may light hundreds of thousands of lamps without itself losing its brilliance. Likewise, a bodhisattva may establish many hundreds of thousands of living beings in enlightenment without his bodhicitta being diminished. In fact, his bodhicitta grows even stronger, even more brilliant as he establishes these living beings in Buddhahood. Likewise, the more you teach and demonstrate the qualities of the Dharma life, the more you will grow in these qualities of the Dharma. This is the Dharma door called the inexhaustible lamp. When you are living in the realm of Mara, inspire innumerable gods and goddesses with the bodhicitta. In such a way, you will repay the kindness of the Buddha and become the benefactors of all living beings. The goddesses bow their thanks. They go off with Mara to the realm of Mara to practice the inexhaustible lamp. Jagatendra is stunned into silence, and he tells the Buddha, I do not want to go to that good man to inquire about his sickness. This is a fantastic story, and there's so much to ponder here and so little time in which to do it. First of all, I think there's a sort of a little sobering lesson for us here. Just be a bit careful when you teach the Dharma, especially, you know, when you have an audience before you that of people who might be very, very attractive to you, might get attracted to you, because Mara might show up and you might get sidetracked. That's the first thing to point. Teaching the Dharma is a highly charged situation. I just say that. And sometimes you can be very easily sidetracked through your teaching of the Dharma, and I probably don't need to say any more. But the whole story and the whole teaching is about the central importance of delight, of pleasure, rati, being found in the Dharma. Rati is actually one of the name of one of Mara's daughters is called Rati. And rati is intensive, sensual, even sexual pleasure. And rati is one of the daughters of Mara who dances before the Buddha, before his enlightenment. You know, you read the descriptions of this in the Lalita Vistara. Whew! I don't know if it was composed by monks, that sutra, but it's pretty racy. And of course, you know, sexual and sensual pleasure in India would be very much associated with pleasure gardens, arama. So Vimalakirti is taking all that language and he's applying it to Dharma practice. Vimalakirti is saying, talking about the need to find an intensity of pleasure in the garden of the Dharma. It's so very, very important in our practice. We have to address this issue of pleasure, of delight in Dharma life. You know what it's like when you start drying up, when you don't find pleasure, when the juice of inspiration, you know, gets lost. When you start drying up, you start going to the old things for pleasure, and it's so easy these days to get your hit, you know, of pleasure. It's easier than ever, and it just takes you away, you know, from the Dharma. And those pleasures can just really restrict and bind us. It's a really, really big topic, this, and perhaps you can really follow it up in the groups. But just a few things before lunch. You know that the Buddha had this great crisis before his enlightenment. You know, he was doing the ascetic practices. He realizes that he's dying. One of the interesting reflections in one sutta about this, it's not just a question of eating solid food and cleaning himself up and all that sort of thing. The big recognition of the Buddha is that he had been suppressing the pleasure, the sukha, born of skillful states. He'd somehow associated the pleasure born of skillful states, the happiness born of skillful states, the fruit of skillful states, that was unskillful. And he realized that this is a big mistake, that pleasure that comes from the generation of skillfulness is nourishment. It's nourishment for the whole psychophysical system. So it's not just about getting some food, it's getting the food as well of the pleasure born of skillfulness. And in this particular sutta, the Mahasachika Sutta, you see the Buddha entering the pleasure of the first dhyana, but he does something very skillful in it. He knows that pleasure should not completely overwhelm his mind. So he keeps his vigilance, his alertness, and the meditations opens up to an even deeper pleasure, the second dhyana. And he goes on like this, spiraling up, unfolding, even to enlightenment itself. And even with the great overwhelming bliss of nirvana, he said, even that pleasure doesn't overwhelm his mind. I think that's there. The sutta is making the point very, very powerfully that the Buddha maintains this vivid awareness even in the great bliss, the liberated bliss of nirvana. But it's really important to remember this. The Buddha says, Nibbanam Paramam Sukham. Nirvana is the supreme bliss. It's higher than any bliss imaginable, even though it's a bliss beyond the subject-object framework, outside of any kind of structuring and conditioning that we can imagine. In Tantric Buddhism, they talk about Yuganada, the two-in-one of bliss and emptiness. And Sangharakshita himself, in a very interesting seminar extract, talks about reality principle and pleasure principle as the middle way. You need to bring together reality, Dharma life, truth, ethics, the path, your vision of the way things are, the effort to change and develop. You need to bring that together with pleasure. In the end, they are completely unified in enlightenment. It isn't, of course, just simply from the classical practices of ethics, meditation, study, and so on, through which we find pleasure. Vimalakirti himself mentions the pleasure, the delight found in spiritual friendship. But Sangharakshita, of course, has added other things. He's talked about the importance of the arts and culture as part playing a major part in our Dharma life, because beauty, of course, gives so much pleasure and deep satisfaction. Nature, of course, the enjoyment of nature, feeling ourselves a part of nature, gives enormous pleasure. But we can add other things. Sports, providing they're not too competitive, give immense pleasure. Work gives pleasure. One of my most pleasurable experiences at Padmaloka is vegetable chopping. I absolutely love and relish a big weekend coming up where there's masses of chopping to do. Get a bit disappointed when we have to put it through the machine to chop it. I much prefer using the knife, you know, just endless carrots. It's really, really deeply satisfying and pleasurable. I ought to do it every day, I think. It would probably keep me sane. I was just thinking about just a little bit of thing to do with the arts and beauty. I've told you that I'm the president of Sheffield. I remember one time I was due to give a talk on metta in the evening at the Dharma night. And I was feeling a little bit dry. I didn't quite have given so many talks on metta, what to say. So I wandered into Sheffield and I went to the Millennium Gallery there, where there was a sound sculpture by Chris Watson about Sheffield. And it included the Buddhist Centre. So I was sitting there listening to the sound of steel and engines and bells and people's voices and the dawn chorus and trams. And then suddenly there's the salutation to the shrine and mantra chanting. And then that faded away into something else. And it was so beautiful. So it created an enormous sort of sympathy and empathy with everybody in that city. That's what it felt like. And I thought, I can now give a talk on the Metta Bhavana. It was art. It really was art, bringing together, well, in my case, my Dharma life and, you know, all these human and non-human sounds in an extremely beautiful way. Very, 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 very powerful, beautiful metta. The great enemy, I think, of finding pleasure in the Dharma, finding this kind of pleasure, you know, in our lives, is passivity. Passivity. I think we really have to work against passivity more than ever before. I think because of technology, people just become very, very passive in relation to the way they get pleasure. You know, it really is the click of the button. And you get into places which are really unpleasant and nasty and which really limit you. If you really want pleasure, ratty, in your Dharma life, you have to be incredibly active. Pleasure is not just something that you know, real pleasure, real satisfaction, real sukha. You can't just be given it. It has to arise through, you know, through your efforts. And real receptivity to pleasure arises when you're making a real effort with your life. And of course, this brings us to the inexhaustible lamp. This beautiful teaching of the single lamp lighting all these other lamps, and the lamp of the bodhicitta blazing more brightly when it's communicated to others, that our dharma qualities grow stronger if we communicate them and demonstrate them and live them in relation to others. We strengthen our dharma qualities when we're involved in, you know, helping other people to develop those qualities. What a fantastic teaching. And it's given to the people, the goddesses, going into the realm of Mara. And of course, we're in the realm of Mara. We're the sons of Mara, aren't we? Let's face it. Here we are. So we have to practice like this. We have to do as much as we can to teach and demonstrate and live and work for and to create the Dharma here for other people. And then the Dharma qualities will grow vivid in us and in other people. It's why I do what I do. I mean, people often say, well, you lived at Padmaloka a long time. You know, don't you feel like moving on? I have to live here because I have to keep explaining to people what it means to be an order member. And then I'm reminding myself of what that actually is. Left to myself, I'd just be thoroughly lazy and probably just watch telly all day if I got the chance. So I do this for me. So I take this Dharma teaching of the inexhaustible lamp very, very seriously.